She got a new dress. She went to the restaurant. She wasn't allowed in the restaurant. She had to put away her new dress. She couldn't see her friends. And she thought about it all week.
Don't wait until it hits you. Get vaccinated. A vaccination passport is now required to enter certain public spaces. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome. I'm Doug Miller, and this is Amandla Radio, a weekly show with news and analysis on the continent of Africa, dispelling negative myths and stereotypes you get from the mainstream media and bringing you the background and in-depth insights you won't get from that same mainstream Western media here at CQUT 90.3 FM. This week, we have our old friend and correspondent, Ahmet Lowe, who's back from 2 months stay in his new home in Senegal. He's bringing his insights to recent events and the situation in Senegal, Chad, and Guinea with a perspective on how to deal with the post-911 jihadi movements. In addition, that's a nice segue into another contribution from the International Crisis Group and their series on the long shadow of the post-911 war on terror. This week, looking at East Africa's jihadis, so stay tuned. To Amandla Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM. I'm interviewing Ahmet Lowe, who's an old friend and Pan-Africanist and a member of GRILA, the Group for Research and Initiatives for the Liberation of Africa, based in Toronto. He's a long-standing resource for us on events, particularly on the western part of the continent. He's originally from Senegal and has just spent 2 months there with his family. So it seemed very opportune to talk with him about life in Senegal in the era of COVID-19 and how the politics of Senegal are shaping up following the protests bordering on uprising last April when several major opposition leaders were detained. In addition, from his perch in Senegal, it was opportune to follow up on the death of Hissène Habré from COVID-19 in prison in Senegal. The former dictator of Chad was serving a life sentence for crimes against humanity, torture, and rape during his time in power from 1982 to 1990. Ahmet gives us insights into how there has been no significant change in the power structure of that country and the international players who support the abuses of those in power. That led us to Guinea and the coup of September 5th this year. In his usual clear and concise style, Amet leads us through the issues behind the coup. Once again, international interference in the daily life of the people and the discontent of the largest part of the population, those are the youth, is critical to what is happening now and what may evolve in the future. Welcome. Welcome back to Amanda Ametlo. It's been a while since we've talked. You've been to Senegal, and my goodness gracious, I'm very, very jealous. How are things in Senegal in a global perspective?
Things are okay, relatively, as good as it can be at this point in time in the context of COVID.
What is the context, the COVID context there? How did you find it and how did it feel?
The situation is that the country is very, very badly hit, not from a medical point of view, but economically. And it has had a very big impact on the economy because when it happened, the Senegalese government kind of replicated the same approach that was being implemented everywhere, like shutting down things and then asking people to stay at home. Which is the same policy that was implemented in advanced countries like in Europe or in North America. However, the situation in those Senegal and those African countries is that you have here an economy where you have almost 90% that is on a survival mode, living day by day. So asking those kind of population to stay at home and then shut down the economy for 2 or 3 months had a very big impact on the economy. So far, there hasn't been in a process of recovery on the economic sides, which make life very difficult. The cost of living has been going up very high. The food prices, transportation, rent, everything is going up. So it looks like it's going to be there for some time. So even though the COVID situation is a little bit more controlled for some reason that nobody knows, but the impact is not as big as it was earlier anticipated that it was going to be. It may be a combination of factors like people not living indoors or the population being very young or people being exposed to stuff like malaria and taking those anti-malaria drugs. They might have helped to develop some type of protection or immunity, but we don't know. From a scientific point of view, we don't know why it happened, but the fact is that the situation is less dramatic as we thought it would be, which is a good sign.
Well, that's actually a very good sign. Back in March, on the other hand, politics seemed to go downhill very quickly. Macky Sall looked like he was lining up anybody in opposition to prevent him running for a third term, although I don't believe that's allowed by the Constitution. Ousmane Sonko was arrested and charged. A son of Wade was arrested. My goodness, what's going on politically? And protests, there were quite vigorous protests. In fact, very reminiscent of what happened in South Africa with the Zuma, the people attacking supermarkets and emptying the shelves. How is the politics of Senegal now?
Yes, the situation have settled down a little bit since then. Ousmane Sonko, who a lot of people believe that he was being framed to be arrested on charges of rape on a girl, is out on bail. The judicial process has been stalled and nothing new happening at the point. But we have witnessed at the time in March of last year, the country has come very close to the worst because the protest was so widespread and so rigorous that it was almost the power of the government was on the street to grab, almost more or less. Wasn't some of the the religious leaders of the country who called, who appealed for calm, and then Sonko was released, it would have gone the other way, and the regime would have most likely fallen. So right now, the situation is kind of on observation mode. Everybody, the different political forces are on the lookout. Everybody trying to observe and preparing for the elections, round of elections that's supposed to happen in 2022. Which is starting in January with the local elections, and then in later on in the year, legislative election where the MPs will be elected. So that will determine the balance of forces to really have a good reading of what's going to happen in the next 2 years. Because as you mentioned, the current president is on his second term, and everybody suspects that he's hesitating and he's planning to make a push for a third term, which is not allowed by the constitutions. But I think that's what's gonna clarify the game is that what will come out from the poll for the next two elections in 2022. Most likely, it may be too easy for him to know that it will be suicidal for him to push for a third term, which a lot of people oppose. So that's the status quo right now. And taken into consideration the economic situation that I mentioned earlier, which is very bad as a result of the COVID impact. You have there all the ingredients that could really fire up the country. And then you have a youth population that is very impatient because of lack of opportunities, lack of jobs, lack of opportunities, and that who are looking for a small change in the direction of the country. And a lot of those youth are seeing an alternative in Ousmane Sonko, who is in a process of building his political forces, because recently he kind of merged his party with 13 or 14 different political organizations, some of them Pan-African organizations, some of them coming from the left. So they are trying to consolidate the forces to have a strong enough political force, a mesh, an engine that could challenge the regime and then take over power eventually in 2024. So we'll see what's going to happen for the next couple of months. That will be very critical on what would happen in 2 years' time.
Wow. Wow. Well, very interesting and to be observed very closely. Just this past month, though, the news came out that Hissane Habré, the former dictator of Chad, who had been serving a prison term in Senegal for war crimes, crimes against humanity and torture, a first in Africa where the impunity of an exiled president was actually, he brought to trial and serving time despite his age. He died of COVID-19. My goodness, was there any, you were there, was there any reaction at the time?
I mean, it was a surprise because it was COVID, so it was not that he was ill for a very long time. It's very sudden, and a few weeks before it happened, there were a lot of human rights organizations who made an appeal to the government to get him released and out of jail because of his fragile health and then the COVID situation, which is very difficult in the prison system right now. There's it's an area of propagation of the virus. So unfortunately, he was not released. But when it happened, a lot of people were kind of split because the personality of Habré kind of have two opposite sides regarding his situation. A lot of people see him as a dictator, and then he's someone who was involved in atrocities when he was in power in Chad. At the same time, other segment of the population see him as a nationalist who kind of resisted a little bit, and it was the reason maybe he was pushed out of power. And that sentiment grows mostly because of the fact that he resisted Gaddafi, the former leader of Libya, who was trying at one point to conquer the northern part of Chad and make it as part of Libya. And then he was one of the person who resisted most about that tentative of invasion of occupation. And so the opinion, the public opinion is kind of divided in half. Some of them seeing him as a hero, some of others seeing him as a dictator. So the debate when he passed away in Senegal last month was reflected in that debate in the media when you have those two trends who are opposing sides. But that brings us more question in terms of the current situation in Chad, because
Idriss Deby just died earlier in the year, right after he got reelected from yet another third term situation.
Right. After having been there for almost 35 years, was killed last couple of months, and the instability that we have in Chad is still the same 30 years ago, or almost you have the country is having a problem to stabilize because there's no infrastructure for the constitution to hold the country together. You have recurrent armed conflicts, rebels movement emerging in the country, whether they are based in Sudan or they're coming across from the Libyan border because of the chaos that exists in Libya. So the underlying cause of instability in the country, in my sense, has not been attacked seriously. And the foundation that could guarantee a stable environment is not yet set. And this is because there's a lot of issues fueling the conflict. There's a question of resources, the question of geopolitical competition between France, who see some of these countries like Chad or Mali or Guinea. We can talk about those other countries later on, but all these countries are seen by the French France-Afrique system as being part of their zone of influence, and then they try to make sure that whoever is willing to protect their interests in those countries stay in place. That's why when Idriss Deby was assassinated and then his son inherited the power, there was very light condemnation of the way he took over power. But if you look in other countries, you would see all this declaration from the United Nations, from France or US, complaining that, you know, that this is unacceptable, that we have to go return to a constitutional order very quickly. But in the case of Chad, it was very, very, very light condemnation. And then what happened is that the son of Deby is now in power in a transition mode where the terms of the transition, in my sense, have not been clarified. What to expect at the end of the transition is not clear to me. And then if those fundamental questions that the transition should have been dealing with during the next 1 year or two until the new president is elected is not resolved, I'm afraid that we might go into a cycle of violence and instability in the future in Chad, because as I say, the root causes of the issues haven't been resolved.
And instability, yes, of course. Oil resource rich, but at the same time, one of the poorest populations in the world. My goodness gracious! And there's Idriss Deby, claiming to be the great survivor, the one who can defend Chad against all these onslaughts. And of course, France, US, everybody's sending arms to them, to him. That is a volatile situation. And what is there any presence of the jihadis in that area?
Oh yeah, the what they call the jihadist movements are spread all in the region, what they call the Sahel region, and they stretch from northern Mali all the way to Burkina Faso, Niger, Chad, and then stretching all the way to the border with Libya. So these movements are very, very agile. They're moving very quickly, and it's because of that Chad has been used as a force to try to contain this expansion of the jihadist movement officially. But underground, we know that there's a lot of geopolitical positioning that's happening. And the US, France, they all have big military bases in the country. And what is happening is that there's a will for the what I would call the imperialist system to get a hold on the natural resources that are in the whole region, and that implies having all this competition between us, between the power sometime, but in the big picture, there is a consensus or between them on dividing the roles they have to play in order to make sure that whoever is in those countries, at the head of those countries, will not challenge the existence of their domination in those countries. And they don't hesitate even to manipulate or use what they describe today as the jihadist forces or the integrist movements, and then portray them as being the major threat, even though they've been in collusion with their with these forces from time to time, depending on the role they play. So, as I say, there's at the core you have the interest of political powers competing to get a monopoly situation on those resources in Chad, in Mali, Estra, and then they kind of play game with the leaders who can best protect their interests. And then if the one day it happens that those leaders are no longer playing that role, they kind of just get rid of them, and or if they get rid of them, try to find another replacement for that.
Is there any sense that the fall of the American withdrawal from Afghanistan and their defeat as an occupying force in Afghanistan, which allowed the Taliban once more to assert themselves, is there any sense that that has encouraged these forces? We've just covered actually an article of by the International Crisis Group for which covered Africa, 9/11's long shadow, escaping 9/11's long shadow, and it points out how jihadi movements actually are active and strengthening, and very much a result not so much of religious fervor, because that is one factor, but often because of all the underlying causes of discontent that and especially young people and young men face. Is there any sense that that's present in the Sahel as well?
Oh yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of movements who feel have more confidence now that they see what happened in Afghanistan with the defeat of US imperialism, even though they've been there for decades pretending to train the security forces of the country. We see how it ended. So I'm sure that it's a source of motivation for lots of this small group. But the analysis I do with this situation is that these groups, they can be defeated not only through military means, but through a combination of, because we have to provide people with alternatives so that they won't have they won't be attracted to join these organizations, which are fighting not for religious reasons, but they have a combination of gangsterism and cultural people who are dreaming for a return to an order that is long gone. You have all this combination of forces that are in these movements. So in my sense, the real alternative from the region would be, first of all, to make sure that the security question that is being a major issue for all these countries is tackled very, very heads on by the regional bodies like ECOWAS or the African countries. Because we cannot continue to outsource the protection of these countries to external forces, who everybody knows that they are mainly driven by their own interests in terms of access to the natural resources. Unfortunately, what's happening is that there's not, at this point in time, the political leadership emerging in different countries to be able to put those countries in a different path than where they have been for the last two decades, because the last alternative in the region was Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso, and he was
murdered in 1987. Oh my gosh, that's 40 years.
Yes, that's a long time ago. And so as long as there's not a political alternative that emerge, it will be very difficult to counter these forces. And the point I make sometimes is that, especially when you compare it with the situation in Algeria, if you remember well, in 1991, that's when the Islamic Salvation Front came to power. And then the Western countries have all supported the regime in place to discredit it and then dismantle, not recognizing their victory through a process of election that occurred. And I think it was a big mistake, because what I say is that most of the forces that you really don't have an alternative to the current political system happening in the world, to the hegemony of forces who are controlling their countries. So if they happen to come through the natural electoral process, which everybody knows is own limitation to win some elections, in my sense, the best way to deal with them is to let them exercise power. And then within one term or two terms, you will see that they have a lot of limitation. And it's been, we can see that in Morocco right now, they had some legislative election 2 or 3 weeks ago. And the party that was so-called an Islamist party, who was in power for the last 10 years, dropped from the position of running the government to the eighth place. That tells you eighth place. So that tells you how dissatisfied the population was with the way they run the country. So because at the end they don't have an alternative to the capitalist system. They don't have the alternative to imperialism. They don't have an alternative to regain sovereignty for their country. All they have most of the time is a cultural response to the expansion of imperialism in their country, and then that's not enough to build an alternative. So what I'm saying most of the time is that people have to be dealing with these forces politically. Militarily is one aspect, but also socially and economically, we have to provide more opportunities to the younger generation of Africans, so that at least people know that if you're busy working 8 to 8 o'clock to 5 o'clock, you'll be thinking to go have a rest or drink your beer after work than going to join a so-called jihadist movement to potentially get killed over there.
Yes, idle hands are dangerous hands, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, you've brought up Morocco and Algeria. That brings us over to the next subject of interest, and that was just a couple of weeks back. There was a coup in Guinea, and my goodness gracious, Alpha Conde, who inserted and imposed himself on the people through gerrymandering, rigging, and all of the regular stuff we know about a controlled election, was overthrown by the army. My goodness gracious, what's going on? What happened there?
Yeah, he was overthrown by the army, but especially by someone he promoted to be at the position to be able to overthrow him. This guy who called Doumbia, who was at the head of this coup, was part of the French army called the French Legion. Which is a conglomerate of people coming from South America, all countries, who is a special branch within the French army. And
the French Foreign Legion, we used to call it.
Yeah, Foreign Legion, yeah, that's what they are called. And this guy was brought into the country, promoted from a low-level position to a top-level position to lead the security forces or a special branch in the army. So, but that's not the cause of all these issues happening. We had a situation where Alpha Conde made a lot of mistakes, in my sense, by trying to force a third term that he was not allowed to do. And then at his age, I believe that he would have been wise to just let the natural process and then try to find someone in his political party take over, and then see what else he can do, what role he can play on the background, and instead of forcing this. And this third term issue is like a cancer right now in the region, because you had the situation in Gabon, you have the situation in Mali, in Ivory Coast, and in Guinea recently. But again, it's because of the geopolitical situation in which we are right now, when you have all this competition and all the different international political forces trying to push whoever will be able to maintain their or keep their interests in place. So that's why even some leaders are pushing for a third term. Most of some time it's being looked the forces who are supposed to to oppose it. They don't say anything. They're complicit, and they even try to push it, to support it, like the case in Ivory Coast. Because these leaders are there to preserve the interests of the French system. So what happened in Guinea also, you had all these actors, because Guinea is the third country in terms of production of bauxite. Bauxite is a natural resource.
So critical, such a critical resource.
Very critical, and it's used for to generate aluminum, etc. They can be making billions of dollars per year only on that natural resource. And they have also gold, they have diamond, they have
iron,
lots of water. All the main rivers flowing in the West African country, they originate from Guinea. At the same time, Guinea doesn't have electricity. They don't have electrical dams.
Again, it's the curse of the resource rich. Poverty and oppression and... Oh my goodness.
Absolutely. And because of that, you have this competition. And that recently, what we have witnessed in the region is that China is gaining a little bit of more influence in terms of the economy. They're gaining more contract. They're dealing more with these African countries in terms of debt, loaning, lending money, those kind of things. You have other actors like Turkey, you have Russia. And they seem to be threatening the monopoly situation that the classical forces enjoyed in the region for centuries, like France and the Western Europe and North America. So everybody is trying to position themselves with their own maneuvering approach in terms of getting more hands on the natural resources of the country. And that's the underlying situation that explains this struggle for power, this third term push sometimes, and also the revolt of the population who are aspiring to have a better system, a better life, because they see that it doesn't make any sense for them to be living on top of gold and being the poorest population in the world, while the rest of the world is enjoying access to those resources and building their countries and building their infrastructure and everything. So that contradiction is at the core of these countries is what is fueling the tentative of revolt, as you mentioned earlier, when it started in the case of Senegal, and also some forces who are allied to the international system who are running the country, preserving the interests of these global powers while getting the crumbs falling from the table. And then you have this small elite of African leaders or intellectuals who are positioning themselves as a bridge between the majority of the population who are struggling to get a better life and on the other side, the major international forces who are thirsty in terms of access to natural resources to build their own economy.
Do I presume that you then have the same doubts about Mamadi Doumbouya as you would have about Déby in Chad? Do you see a way out that's going to give the people some voice?
No, unfortunately, I don't see any hope, is because the first action he's taking since he came to power doesn't seem to be to me as being really politically thought out. Because as I say in some of the discussion forum that I participate, I say that I like to quote Thomas Sankara, who say that a military without a political education is a potential murderer. So when people come to power without having a well-thought-out framework of what to do in those countries, when they come to on the head of these countries, they're just trying things. But the vision is not there. And I can feel it in this case of Doumbouya here, because for a conjunction of circumstances, he happened to be leading this coup. But I don't think that he really have a vision because an example of that is that when he did the coup, one of his first declarations was that we're not going to shut down the country. The economic activities impacting the mining sector will continue to grow. So because of that, there will be no curfew in the region where the mining operations are happening. and then they take the resolution that they will accept all the signature that were done by the state of Guinea in relation to the exploitation of these natural resources. So that tells me that he's not someone who is really in a path or willing to reorder things or challenge things or to renegotiate at least the terms of access to those resources, which is most of the time very unbalanced. The country gets nothing out of usually if you take a look, for example, for mining operation like involving oil, most of the national companies, they own 10% of the production against 90% of the international corporation who are active in terms of exploitation of these resources. And I don't see, unfortunately, if in this case in Guinea, leadership that is really ready to challenge that. And then that's why I'm hoping that the transition will be very short. And then at least they can lay out the framework of what we call a normal country from a liberal point of view, like let's say a stable democratic system, even though it's offered the bourgeois form, which is very not going to the very deeply, but at least stabilize the country so that maybe there will be a possibility from that point on to have political forces emerging to propose a different alternative to the current situation.
Wow, that's quite a global sweep there, Ahmet, of the region. Any last words before we part?
The last word is that we have to keep a close eye, because what I've observed during the last 2 months that I've been there in Senegal is that there's something bubbling underneath the apparent calm that we have, and then the populations have reached a point, in my sense, in a lot of situations where they don't want what is happening right now. And then they are not ready to continue to leave that. And because of that, they can be very radical in their approach. What is missing so far is the emergence of a political force that is capable of channeling that unrest or that anger into a more productive process of transformation. Because if that doesn't happen, what can happen in most of the time is this burst of violence sometime through military coups, through insurrection, as we have witnessed in the case of Burkina Faso in 2014 or in Egypt. And then there's not the political forces that can carry it over and take it to the next level of really taking the foundation of what these countries are based, which is a neo-colonial system that hasn't been really transformed after the end of colonization, but we've just had a new elite of African leaders who come and then take over and then continue the same policy. And you can see witness that in terms of how these countries are laid out, the constitutional framework, the way the economy is organized, the role of the army, the education system is not reflecting African values or African priorities, and all those things have to be reconceptualized, and it requires someone or a group of people who have the vision to get organized enough to be able to channel the potential popular revolts that are brewing under the surface to come into something more constructive and more real in the long run.
Well, thank you ever so much, Ahmet. As usual, clear, concise, to the point, and very direct. Systemic change must happen, and we're not getting there very fast with the way it's going now. So thanks again for your insights, and we'll be back to you soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. And thank you for the great work. Always appreciated that the African voice is being heard through programs like yours. And then it's important that people in the Western countries also get a different picture of what's happening, because at the end of the day, the people, wherever they are, they can share some common vision on of a better world that's more balanced, more just, based on justice, on equity. And it's important that this voice continue to be heard.
True solidarity.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Bye.
Please don't bother your soul trying to understand that philosophy. It's all about hypocrisy. So don't bother your soul trying to buy into their fashion. They'll only take away your passion. Please don't bother your soul. Don't you see, don't you see, don't you see, don't you see? The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. Trying to understand their philosophy. It's all about hypocrisy. Please don't bother your soul now. Trying to buy into their fashion. They'll only take away your passion. So don't bother your soul now. Playing the game. They'll only fuck with your name. Don't you see, don't you see, don't you see, don't you see? The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. The system is a joke. All they feed us is coke. Circles, such a circles. We're moving in circles, we're moving in circles. Oh my, what a circus now. We're moving in circles, we're moving in circles. Oh, what a circus.
I want to recall for you what we played last week about the International Crisis Group paper issued on 10 September entitled Africa, Escaping 911's Long Shadow. It was written by Comfort Ero and Muriti Mutiga, which provided a comprehensive overview of the failure of the war on terror in Africa, and in fact has left the continent much worse off than before the American reaction to the 911 events. Their paper is part of a special series of papers and podcasts by the International Crisis Group entitled The Legacy of 911 and the War on Terror, a special series. Look it up at crisisgroup.org. Excellent material. Tonight, I'm playing a panel presentation from the series, which goes by the title of Eastern Africa Jihadis, The War on Terror. This is just the first part of that discussion. The larger part of this very informative discussion will play next week. So I'll let them introduce their work and the panelists involved.
Hi, and welcome to a special series and a special episode of The Horn, a podcast from the International Crisis Group. I'm Alan Boswell. And this is the finale of our five-week mini-series, Eastern Africa's Jihadis, produced in partnership with the Friedrich Ebert Foundation, or FES. Today, we're trying something a bit different. We've brought on a fantastic and timely panel to discuss how the global war on terror has shaped the trajectory of the region in the past 20 years and where it all heads from here. With us, we have Mary Harper, Africa editor at the BBC and author of two books on Somalia, including her most recent on Al-Shabaab, Michael Waldemariam, a professor and director of the African Studies Center at Boston University, and Muriti Mutiga, Crisis Group's Horn of Africa director. Thanks to all of you for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks, Alan.
Now, we've done a little series here looking at the current state of jihadism in East Africa and a bit of its history. When we planned this, we didn't know we'd have such a dramatic backdrop as we've gotten with Afghanistan to sort of mark this moment. But as I was preparing this and looking back, I have to say I didn't quite realize how much, you know, this 20-year period has really shaped the region country by country. When you go through from Sudan and the birth of South Sudan to Eritrea and Ethiopia to Kenya and Uganda and, of course, Somalia, you know, it's difficult to find a country whose fate wasn't drastically affected by what happened on 9/11 and then, of course, subsequently. So, Mary, I'm going to start with you. We're fortunate to have you as you've been covering this region for so long. And we've been in this 9/11 era for, you know, such a long time that it's difficult to really think back before then sometimes. So can you help us out? What did the U.S. approach in the region look like before 9/11? And then how did you really see it shift?
Sure. I mean, what we mustn't forget is that before 9/11 in the U.S., there were very big al-Qaeda attacks in East Africa. The U.S. embassies in Tanzania and in Kenya were hit by al-Qaeda in 1998, leading to very large amount of deaths. So in some ways, East Africa, the Horn of Africa, was already primed for this. Also, Osama bin Laden had for some time spent time in Sudan in the 1990s. So in some ways, the kind of groundwork was already done. But then obviously when 9/11 happened and the world's foremost superpower was struck directly, this then kind of changed things on the ground in the Horn of Africa and East Africa once again. And George Bush, very soon afterwards, pointed the finger at least at a Somali money transfer company, blaming it for being a major source of funding for al-Qaeda. So I think there is a kind of before and an after story in terms of how those events of 9/11 hit Africa, because it was already being affected and continues to be affected to this day.
Now, Marithi, you were, of course, in Nairobi during those events in the 90s. I'm just wondering if you can reflect on that pre-9/11 period, and then also, how has life since changed?
Thanks, Alan. And I think Mary makes a very good point. I would go even further back that, unhappily for this region, jihadism has been a part of life for a very long time. You had in the late 80s, members, especially of Al-Ittihad Al-Islami, this group in Somalia, moving to the mountains of Afghanistan to train partly with bin Laden's group. But then also you had recruits from places like Sudan, to a lesser degree, the Kenyan coast and Tanzania. And then, as Mary rightly pointed out, a hinge point was bin Laden moving to Sudan in the early 90s. And in that period, then you had a chain of events that touched this region very, very significantly. You had, for example, a few of bin Laden's early recruits moving to Somalia, training some of the people involved in the Black Hawk Down episode. You had the horrific attacks in Nairobi on August 7th. I was in high school at that time. My high school had just closed, and some of my classmates were actually right outside the embassy when the bomb went off. It was a period of profound shock, a period of profound confusion. Nobody had heard of Al-Qaeda. How has it changed the region? I would say that in the first phase, people saw it as an external problem. But then the global war on terror, so-called, began. Many of the governments in this part of the world enlisted themselves, and then it became a war in which civilians were paying an incredible price. I don't remember ever encountering security guards going into supermarkets, into banks, into various shops or malls in Nairobi. I was very stunned a couple of years ago to see that the biggest private sector employer in the country is not somewhere in agriculture, is not in tourism, it's actually private security companies. You see CCTV everywhere, the airport is ringed by security. Life has changed very substantially. And of course, we can discuss further what mistakes were made to get to this point.
Michael, I'm going to go over to you, and I'm wondering, besides any reflections you might have on what Mary and Marithi said, When you think of what changed in the equation after 9/11 for the U.S., what exactly did that look like? And as Marithi mentions, how did regional governments get sucked in as well?
Yeah, so I would say that one would be hard-pressed to find sort of a clear strategic line from the United States or Western countries towards the Horn in the pre-9/11, this period from the end of the Cold War till 9/11. I mean, counterterrorism certainly wasn't a huge issue. There was a lot of focus on humanitarian concerns. I mean, see the US-UN intervention in Somalia in the 1990s. I think humanitarianism was the big impetus there. But I think as Marithi and Mary have noted, there were obviously concerns about jihadist networks in the region. And much of that centered on the role of Sudan in facilitating some of those networks. So in the 1990s, the United States relationship with Sudan really hits rock bottom because of Khartoum's kind of involvement with these networks. And the United States begins to support, in a strategic sense, a kind of alliance in the region to contain Sudan. I think it's important to mention this. So Uganda, Ethiopia, and Eritrea. And so that, you know, to the degree that counterterrorism matters in this period in the 1990s, it's part and parcel of the strategic containment of Sudan. But obviously after 9/11, I think it's fair to say that from the perspective of Western countries, counterterrorism becomes sort of the central strategic interest for the United States and European partners in the Horn of Africa. And I think we'll get into this more, but a number of countries in the region recognized that fact and sought to instrumentalize the war on terror for their own political gain, in particular for the consolidation of political power at home.
Thanks, Michael. And of course, that strategy you mentioned about containing Sudan from the U.S. also in practice bolstered the SPLA rebellion in the South with, of course, major consequences later. That segues me pretty well to taking us into a bit more of these specifics rather than the broad scope. Of course, I think when people think of the war on terror in this region, they often think of Somalia first. But I'm actually going to first go and ask about Sudan, which we've already started talking about, because I think in some ways, Sudan was the place where perhaps the earliest effects of this big overall change was perhaps most felt. Now, I'm going to punt this one over to you, Marithi. Obviously, Sudan was already on the state sponsor of terror when 9/11 happened. But then how did 9/11 and the events that follow really change the direction of that country, you know, really significantly?
Yes. So, of course, we have to remember that the coup in 1989 that brought Omar al-Bashir in power was very much supported by an Islamist group that was further to the right of people like Bashir. And so he felt under pressure to prove his Islamist credentials. Of course, then there was a degree to which he became host to a number of groups that were just more than Islamist, were perhaps more Salafi jihadist. And then when 9/11 happened, I think Bashir saw a threat to his survival. I think the most important development was the ouster of Saddam Hussein just 2 years later. He saw this as an existential threat. So while we should not overstate this, it's important to note that Bashir was already under very significant cross-party pressure over in DC because of the abuses in Darfur. To ensure the survival of his regime, he began to offer substantial counterterrorism cooperation to the US. And in this period, when he was in a very weak position, then, of course, we know that the long struggle for South Sudanese independence had been bubbling for a long time. They were demanding a referendum on secession. And I think in that weak moment, it's very important to recognize what a massive concession it was, even for a weak Khartoum, to agree to the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, but they did. And I think that's one of the significant developments that took place in the region. The fact that these autocrats saw that to survive, they had to enlist somehow in the so-called war against terror, but also very significant domestic developments happened in that period.
Mm-hmm. And Mary, of course, you've written about how 9/11 has not only changed the fate of Somalia, but even you wrote once as even rewrote Somalia's history in a way. I'm wondering, what did you mean by that? And maybe can you just remind our listeners and walk us through how the U.S. approach and even regional approach that took place after 9/11, how it's led us to the current situation in Somalia today.
I don't want to oversimplify, but what I argued in my book, which is called Getting Somalia Wrong, so that might give you a hint, is that after 9/11, Somalia was associated with this whole very extreme, violent branch of Islamism. And to put it sort of simply, during that time, there were a bunch of warlords who were causing havoc in Somalia and controlling different bits of the territory, even different bits of the capital, Mogadishu. And they were backed in part by the CIA, because they said that they were countering an Islamist threat. And then, much to everybody's surprise, this group of Sharia courts, which had been providing security in some parts of the country and really changing things, they actually overthrew these warlords and came to some kind of power, at least in the capital, Mogadishu, and other parts of South and Central Somalia. Then what happened was that they did, without trying to kind of paint too bright a picture on them, but they did dramatically improve security and made people's lives much more predictable. But after just 6 months of them being in power, the Americans and the Ethiopians and a few others, they basically labeled this Islamic Courts Union, as it was called, as a sort of Al-Qaeda affiliate, having sympathy with violent Islam, and they bombed them out of existence. And what happened was that the sort of armed youth wing that had been associated with the courts, they disappeared into the bush, but reemerged as Al-Shabaab. And to this day, it controls vast swathes of the country and attacks towns and cities that are officially controlled by the government and its allies. So, I mean, it is oversimplistic to say that American policy created Al-Shabaab, a little bit like some argue that American policy created the Taliban in Afghanistan. But there was definitely a link between American policy and the flourishing of Al-Shabaab.
Thanks, Mary. Michael, can you also expand a bit more on how regional countries were able, as you mentioned, to instrumentalize this war on terror and play their own role?
I mean, I think with the benefit of hindsight and sort of taking a broad view, and obviously there's country by country variation here, I think we can say that the war on terrorism has mostly had negative impacts on democracy and governance in the Horn of Africa. And I think there are a couple of mechanisms at work here. You know, the first is that the United States and other Western countries in this period were oftentimes very reluctant to push hard on sort of issues of democracy and governance with a number of countries in the region so as not to jeopardize their counterterrorism partnerships. So, you know, I think the classic cases of this would be Uganda, Ethiopia under the EPRDF, Djibouti. I think it's also the case that authoritarians, autocrats in the region have instrumentalized the war on terror for the purposes of regime maintenance through access to external security assistance, by sort of very effectively blurring the line politically and legally between terrorism and what, you know, otherwise might be considered legitimate political activity. And then I think, you know, I'll maybe leave it here. I think the war on terror frame offered sort of new moral and legal justifications for the use of specific coercive tools by governments in the region. I'm thinking about extrajudicial assassinations, rendition, torture, surveillance. I don't think these governments used these tools because of the war on terror. These tools were in existence before that, but it did provide sort of new moral and legal justifications for their deployment.
Well, that's it for Amandla Radio here at CKUT 90.3 FM for this week. Thanks to our dear friend and comrade Amit Lowe for his wisdom and insights. Thanks to the folks at the International Crisis Group for their reality check on the impact of the war on terror that the US has waged for the last 20 years on Africa. More from them next week. And thanks to the CKUT staff who have kept the station and this show on the air through a very difficult year and a half. Please think of sending any support you can. Check the website at ckut.ca. I'm Doug Miller. Gwen's not here to remind me of all the things I forgot to say, so please wish her a good trip and a speedy return to home. We miss her. Stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium. Africa unite, Batsilelile.
Laurie a hâte de célébrer son anniversaire au resto. Elle y a pensé toute la semaine. Elle a invité ses amis. Elle a acheté une nouvelle robe. Elle s'est rendue au resto. Elle n'a pas pu rentrer dans le resto. Elle a dû ranger sa nouvelle robe. Elle n'a pas pu voir ses amis. Et elle y a pensé toute la semaine.
N'attendez pas de frapper un mur. Faites-vous vacciner. Le passeport vaccinal est maintenant exigé pour fréquenter certains lieux publics. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Join Pop Montreal's 20th edition this September, featuring a very special presentation. Cakes to Killa, DJ SB, Shades Lawrence, DJ Killa Jewel, and Milla Time at Launchercombe 77 on September 23rd, 2021. Doors open at 3:30 p.m., and tickets are on sale now. Do not miss this iteration of hip-hop in the Mile End. More info at popmontreal.com. This is a CKUT co-presentation as part of Pop Montreal International Music Festival.